Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter. Pretty good Bible studies. I am now going to endeavor to study the book of 2 Kings. The original book of Kings was not divided into 1 and 2 Kings. The Septuagint translators did that for us as they divided the law into five books of the Pentateuch, and as they divided Samuel into 1 and 2 Samuel, so they divided Kings up. Now, I've already given some introduction material when I covered 1 Kings chapter 1. Let me go over that again. The date of the compilation of the book, or the authorship of the book, was between 561 and 538. Those dates seem to be pretty standard. Wikipedia goes with that. Barnes goes with that. GotQuestions.org says between 560 and 540, which is close enough. That date is arrived at because the last chapter of 2 Kings discusses evil Merodach. The first year of his reign, the Babylonian king, was 561 BC, and so the book had to be written after that. How far after that? As we go from 561, we get all the way down to 538. It couldn't have been written after that because that is the date of the return of the Jews from their Babylonian captivity, and that surely would have been mentioned, so it must have been written before 538. So after 561 and before 538. Now, the author is, by tradition, Jeremiah, but this is a strong tradition. The Jews held that. GotQuestions.org says, quote, "The tradition is that it was written by the prophet Jeremiah." Wikipedia gives evidence for that. There are some portions that are almost identical to the book of Jeremiah, and they give examples. There are also many undesigned coincidences between Jeremiah and Kings, and events recorded in Kings of which Jeremiah had personal knowledge. That's a lot of evidence. The commentator Barnes says this, quote, "There are very weighty arguments in favor of this view that Jeremiah wrote the book. There is a very remarkable affinity between the language of Kings and that of the admitted writings of the prophet. The matter, moreover, of the two works, so far as the same events are treated, is in the closest harmony, those points being especially singled out for insertion of which Jeremiah had personal knowledge and in which he took a personal interest. Another argument of very considerable force is drawn from the entire omission of any notice at all of Jeremiah and Kings, which would have been very strange and unnatural in any other historian, considering the important part which Jeremiah played in the transactions of so many reigns, but which is completely intelligible on the hypothesis of his authorship of Kings. It is then the natural fruit and sign of a becoming modesty and unselfishness. Still, though Jeremiah's authorship appears, all things considered, to be highly probable, we must admit that it has not been proved and is therefore to some extent uncertain." Well, it's close enough for me. We're going to give Jeremiah the credit for writing the book. Now, even though he wrote the book, that doesn't mean he didn't use sources. There's lots of sources, three basic sources that are used here. There's a book of Kings, there's a book of the Annals of Solomon, the book of the Annals of the Kings of Israel, and the book of the Chronicles of Judah. So, Jeremiah is the compiler, the editor, the author, whatever you want to call him, in all probability. And by the way, Ezra was probably the author of the book of Chronicles, which we take a peek into every now and then as we go through these books of Kings. So now let's start with 2 Kings 1, verse 1. "Now Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab." Now Moab had been subject to Israel since the times of David. Moab, of course, is the pagan nation that is to the east of the Dead Sea. We see it was subject to David in 2 Samuel 8:2. "He," David, "also defeated the Moabites, and after making them lie down on the ground, he measured them off with a cord. He measured every two cord lengths of those to be put to death and one length of those to be kept alive." So the Moabites became David's subjects and brought tribute. Now we're way past the time of David. Now we're in the time of Ahab, and Moab is apparently under the rulership of northern Israel because they rebelled here in verse 1. Well, how did that happen? Because David was the king of Judah. Well, he was the king of Judah and Israel, but how did Moab end up under Israel's thumb and not under Judah's thumb? Adam Clark speculates the reason is that after the division of the two kingdoms, north and south, Moab was partly under Israel's control and partly under Judah's control. I don't believe that. I never heard of two nations spending most of their time fighting each other, having joint sovereignty over another nation. I don't think Clark's right at all. Jameson Fawcett and Brown gives the more likely answer is that after the division of the north and the south, Moab just fell to the north for whatever reasons we don't know. Adam Barnes confirms this as the general view. or Alfred Barnes, confirms this as the general view by saying that Moab was, quote, dependent on the kingdom of Israel, to which it has been generally supposed that they fell at the separation of Israel from Judah. Now, those commentators didn't mention, or one of them didn't mention, the Moabite monument, the Misha Stele, famous one, discovered in 1869 in Dibon, which is in Moab, famous city in Moab. Let me read you what Barnes says about that. The Moabite monument, which is the Misha Stele, Misha was a king of Moab. He wrote some stuff on this rock that was found in 1869 in Dibon in Moab. The Moabite monument, discovered in 1869, has now given reason to believe that they then recovered their independence. Moab got their independence. In other words, when the northern and southern kingdoms split, that makes a lot of sense. They're fighting each other now that they don't have time to rule over Moab, take tribute from them. But then the Moabite monument says that they were again the Moabites reduced by Omri, that's Ahab's father. And Omri, with his son Ahab, is said to have oppressed them for 40 years. Ahab's death was seized upon as an occasion for revolt, and Moab, perhaps owing to Ahaziah's sickness, easily regained her independence. Well, that makes sense. So we have some confirmation with archaeology that Moab is rebelling at this time, maybe because of Ahab's death, maybe because of Ahaziah's sickness. Northern Israel is in a mess. They're weak, and so they rebel. We go now to 2 Kings 1, verses 2 through 6. Ahaziah had fallen through the latticed window of his upper room in Samaria and was injured. So he sent messengers instructing them, "Go inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, if I will recover from this injury." But the angel of the Lord said to Elijah the Tishbite, "Go and meet the messengers of the king of Samaria and ask them, 'Is it because there is no god in Israel that you are going to inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron?' Therefore, this is what the Lord says, 'You will not get up from your sick bed. You will certainly die.'" Then Elijah left. The messengers returned to the king, who asked them, "Why have you come back?" They replied, "A man came to meet us and said, 'Go back to the king who sent you and declare to him, this is what the Lord says. Is it because there is no god in Israel that you are sending these men to inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron? Therefore, you will not get up from your sick bed. You will certainly die.'" Now, this is how I remember Ahaziah. He's a two-year wonder, 853 to 852, who died by falling through a lattice. Strange way to die. He was probably peeping Tommen, looking at a woman undressing in a room nearby, kind of like David did. He fell through the lattice as he was looking. I'm totally making that up. I don't know why he fell, but he did. That word lattice could either be a window lattice, or it could be a balcony rail. Could even be a skylight. It's not exactly sure because of the translation what he fell through, but basically he fell to the ground and hurt himself. So he goes to a god to tell him what's going to happen. Baal-zebub, the famous Lord of the Flies, because that's what Baal-zebub means. It's strange that he wouldn't just ask Baal-zebub to heal him outright instead of just inquiring, "What's going to happen to me?" That shows they didn't really have a lot of faith in these idol gods. It was more superstitious, like reading a horoscope. His relationship with Baal-zebub really sort of superstitious. Some think that the idol in Ekron that was worshipped was actually a large metallic fly instead of the Lord of the Flies. He's Lord of the Flies, and this big metallic fly is a symbol of all the flies that Baal-zebub was lord of. Later, the name Baal-zebub became a common name for Satan himself. This, to me, is the grossest of all the idols. If you have not seen the movie and read the book Lord of the Flies, God, who wrote it now, J.D. Salinger, who was screwed up. But boy, oh boy, did it give you an idea of what people will do without God or their conscience to restrain them. They will turn into animals and barbarians, sort of like the human race. That's why the book is so good. So the angel of the Lord, and I'm assuming that's Jesus in a human form, came to Elijah the Tishbite. Tishbite is a place called Tishbe. The place called Tishbe. Nobody knows where it is, somewhere up in the north. So Jesus says to Elijah, the angel of the Lord says to Elijah, "Go intercept these messengers of the king and say, 'Where are you going? What you going to Ekron for? Why are you going to talk with Baal-zebub? You can't ask Yahweh? There's no Yahweh in Israel that you can ask?'" Now Elijah's dates are around 900 BC, and he died in 849 BC. That's Wikipedia. I've seen some other estimates that weren't quite the same, but they're close by. Basically, the way to remember when Elijah occurred is in the reigns of two northern kings, Ahab and Ahaziah. Ahab and Ahab's son, Ahaziah. Just remember those two dates, and you're in good shape. Ahab's dates are 874 to 853, and Ahaziah's 853 to 852. I've seen one estimate, a round number for Elijah is 870 to 850. That's close enough. Well, that's not really quite. Yeah, that's close enough. That covers both the reigns, Ahab and Ahaziah. So Jesus tells Elijah what to tell Ahaziah, and then in verse 4 it says, then Elijah left. Well, I assume he means he left from the angel of the Lord to go intercept the messengers, and Ellicott and the Cambridge commentary agree with me on there, but surprisingly to me, Poole and the pulpit commentary say that no, he actually went to the messengers and then he left the messengers, which would assume some action in the middle of verse 4 that's not stated. Well, I don't think that's right. I think he just left the angel of the Lord to go meet the messengers. Now, the next question is, where was Elijah leaving from? Well, Elijah is seen at Mount Carmel. He's seen at the banks of the Jordan. He's seen in Samaria. So I'm not really sure where he was leaving from. We read in 2 Kings 2:25, he went from there, that's the banks of the Jordan, where he commissions Elisha. He went from the banks of the Jordan to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to Samaria. So I don't know where he was, but wherever he was, he left the angel of Jehovah and goes to meet and to intercept these messengers who were sent out by King Ahaziah. Now in verse 4, the angel of the Lord has told Elijah to say this to Ahaziah, you will not get up from your sick bed. The actual original Hebrew is, you will not come down from your sick bed. The NASB translates it that way. And that's because in Eastern countries, the custom was to have a bed raised 4 or 5 feet above the floor, and there was a balustrade in front of the bed to keep people from falling off. So you're not going to come down. The Holman Christian Study Bible makes it more modern. It says you're not going to get up. Either way, the point is, you're going to die. Well, the messengers, having heard that word from Elijah, they go back to Ahaziah. And when they come back in verse 5, Ahaziah says, why have you come back? Ahaziah must have known the messengers couldn't have gotten to Ekron and come back so quickly, so he's thinking, what's going on here? Now, why did the messengers come back when Elijah confronted them? Well, they must have felt the authority of Elijah's words. They had their answer from a prophet of God. And by golly, Ahaziah, you're going to die. And I'm sure Elijah used an authoritative tone, a commanding attitude as he gave the prophecy to the messengers. And so the messengers relay the message, the bad message, to Ahaziah. We go now to 2 Kings 1, verses 7 through 12. He, that's Ahaziah, said to the messengers, what kind of man was he who came up to meet you and spoke these words to you? They answered him, he was a hairy man with a leather girdle bound about his loins. And Ahaziah said, it is Elijah the Tishbite. Then the king Ahaziah sent to Elijah a captain of 50 with his 50 soldiers. And the captain of the 50 went up to Elijah. And behold, Elijah was sitting on the top of the hill. And the captain of the 50 said to Elijah, O man of God, the king says, Ahaziah says, come down. Elijah replied to the captain of the 50, if I am a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. Then fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. So he, that's Ahaziah, King Ahaziah, again sent to Elijah another captain of 50 with his 50. That's the second 50. And the captain of the second 50 said to Elijah, O man of God, thus says the king Ahaziah, come down quickly. Elijah replied to them, if I am a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. Then the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50, the second captain and his 50. So Ahaziah asked his messengers, what kind of man was it that you met and gave you that bad word? A hairy man, they reply. Well, what's hairy? It could be Elijah's head. He had grown a lot of hair being a prophet. Or it could be Elijah's hairy garment, an animal skin with a hair still on it. But that's kind of what prophets wore. They weren't your preppy type. They weren't your social climbing type. Well, when he heard the hairy man in the leather girdle, Ahaziah says, oh, I know who that is. It's Elijah the Tishbite. How did he know it was Elijah? Because Ahaziah knew Elijah, because Elijah had been in his father Ahab's court. Elijah was well known. I mean, he had prophesied against Ahab so many times, as we've been reading here in 1 Kings. So Ahaziah, he knew who he was, and he knew it was bad news, and so he sent 50 men to kill him. Well, I say to kill him. There are actually some other options as to why Ahaziah sent the 50 soldiers to capture Elijah. Maybe he just wanted Elijah to come to Ahaziah so he could confirm the prophecy or talk to him some more about the prophecy. But you have to ask yourself, well, why did he need to send 50 soldiers to do that? Why did he just send some messengers and ask Elijah to come voluntarily? Well, it could be he didn't do that because he knew Elijah would not come voluntarily, because Elijah would be justifiably afraid that Elijah wanted to kill him. So I assume that Ahaziah sent those 50 soldiers to kill Elijah outright. And it's obvious that Elijah was afraid of being killed when he saw the 50 soldiers and fire from heaven, because he knew that these were not just messengers. They were coming to get him, to at least imprison him and probably kill him. Now, Elijah actually did come voluntarily to see Ahaziah when we get to verse 15, after fire from heaven has destroyed 100 soldiers, and the third captain of his 50 says, I don't think I want to get fried. Why don't you just come on down, Elijah? And the angel of the Lord says in verse 15, says to Elijah, go down with him. Go down with this captain of the third 50. Do not be afraid of him. Do not be afraid of the captain. So Elijah arose and went down with him to King Ahaziah. But at any rate, 50 men showing up, soldiers, armed soldiers, yes, their intentions were hostile. What would you do if 50 people showed up? Would you assume they're just there to sit down and have some tea? I don't think so. Now, this fire that came down from heaven twice, I'm assuming it's lightning. Fire is often translated as lightning in the Old Testament. One of my commentators says it was a flash of lightning that destroyed them at once. This fire that came down from heaven was not an effect. It was not a result of Elijah's personal hatred of the 50. It was surely a matter of self-defense, and it was for the glory of God. Ahaziah was trying to kill one of the greatest prophets of God. So Elijah had a right to call down that fire from heaven on the heads of those 50 soldiers. They were trying to kill him. Self-defense. The reason I say that is because some like to blame Elijah for this. Oh, how could a man of God do that? Well, Elijah didn't really do it. It was God that did it. You might as well blame God for this. Now, Adam Clark, who was so concerned that Elijah might have done something evil by killing those 50 soldiers, he's the soft-hearted Arminian. He says this, quote, Elijah personally had no concern in the business. God led him simply to announce on these occasions what he, God himself, had determined to do. And Clark goes on to say that the original Hebrew says, fire shall come down from heaven and fire shall consume thee, with emphasis on the shall. So Elijah's words were only declarative and not imprecatory. Oh, God forbid that we would have an imprecatory statement in the Old Testament. Please, if you want to get Elijah off the hook by just saying he announced what was going to happen, saying this is what's going to happen, guys, boom, and the fire comes. Well, then now you got to worry about why God did it. Are we going to start trying to justify what God did? Oh, it just wasn't fair. I don't know what it is about Arminians that just can't understand that God has a right to judge people and a prophet of God has a right to execute that judgment. There's no need to blame Elijah here. He's acting in self-defense for the glory of God. Now, Ahaziah sends two groups of 50, two squadrons of soldiers of 50 each. That shows that Ahaziah is a pretty stubborn man to go after Elijah after 50 of his soldiers had already been killed. So he sent another 50, and they got killed in the same way. So we go now to verses 13 through 16. So he, that's Ahaziah, again sent the captain of a third 50 with his 50 soldiers. When the third captain of 50 went up, he came and bowed down on his knees before Elijah and begged him and said to him, O man of God, please let my life and the lives of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. In other words, don't fry me like you fried my two predecessors and their accompanying soldiers. We've got 102 dead soldiers. I don't want any more. Please go easy on me. This man recognized that Elijah was nobody to be messed with. The captain of the third 50 continues in verse 14, Behold, fire came down from heaven and consumed the first two captains of 50 with their 50s. But now let my life be precious in your sight. In other words, please don't kill me. Verse 15, the angel of the Lord said to Elijah, and I'm assuming that's Jesus, Go down with him, do not be afraid of him. So he, that's Elijah, arose and went down with the third captain to the king Ahaziah. Verse 16, Then Elijah says to Ahaziah, "Thus says the Lord, because you have sent messengers to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, is it because there is no god in Israel to inquire of his word? Therefore, you shall not come down from the bed where you have gone up, but you shall surely die." So Elijah does exactly what God, the angel of the Lord, has told him to do. Now, the fact that Ahaziah sent the third group of 50 soldiers to kill Elijah is amazing. It shows how hardened and insolent Ahaziah was. He's already lost 100 soldiers, so he's going to try again. What's the definition of insanity? Repeating the same thing over and over again and expecting the same results? Ahaziah didn't realize he was messing with God, because Elijah was not acting on his own. The angel of the Lord is mentioned several times in this passage. The angel of the Lord, probably Jesus, is telling Elijah what to do and when to do it. Now, this angel of the Lord in verse 15, Jesus, told Elijah not to be afraid, and Elijah had good reason to be afraid. First of all, he had told Ahaziah that he was going to die, and people that receive bad news love to kill the messenger. That's just human nature. You don't like the message, kill the messenger. Another reason Elijah had to be afraid, because he had interrupted the journey of Ahaziah's messengers, who were told to go to Ekron to inquire of Beelzebub, and Elijah had stopped that. And, of course, Elijah had also killed two of Ahaziah's military officers and 100 soldiers. That would be something that might get Ahaziah a little upset. And, as John Gill adds, Elijah had killed 450 of Ahab's prophets of Baal. Ahab, of course, being Ahaziah's father. But Ahaziah's mother was still alive, Jezebel. She's still alive. And she's not going to be happy with Elijah. And so he's going to go tootling down there to Samaria where Jezebel was. Jezebel's already tried to kill him once. Let's see where Elijah had killed 450 of Ahab's prophets of Baal. That's in 1 Kings 18:40. This was after Elijah had won the contest with said prophets, when the fire came down from heaven and burned up Yahweh's sacrifice and not Baal's sacrifice. So Elijah says to the people of Ahab, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape." So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. So Elijah has already been somewhat of an enemy of the northern kingdom of Israel, the dynasty of Omri, Ahab, and Jezebel, and Ahaziah. They don't like this guy. So Elijah had a good reason to be afraid to go down there, but Jesus encouraged him. The angel of the Lord said, go down there. Now, Elijah had to be a brave man who trusted in God to go down in the midst of all this opposition. Now, it's true, once he fled from Jezebel, when Jezebel was trying to kill him, after the contest with the prophets of Baal, and Elijah retreated all the way down to Mount Sinai, and he was depressed, and he was afraid. But he listened to God, and when the chips were down, he responded properly. So now we go to 2 Kings 1, verses 17 through 18. Ahaziah, he reigned from 853 to 852 B.C. Ahaziah died according to the word of the Lord that Elijah had spoken. Since he had no son, Joram, who ruled from 852 to 841, he became king in Ahaziah's place. Now, Joram is the brother of Ahaziah, not the son, because Ahaziah had no son. And so Joram, the brother of Ahaziah, takes over. And Ahaziah and Joram are the only two sons of Ahab, the only two sons that matter, at least. So Joram is now king. And this ascension of Joram happened in the second year of Judah's king Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat. The rest of the events of Ahaziah's reign, along with his accomplishments, are written in the historical record of Israel's kings. That's just an annal of the northern kingdom from which probably Jeremiah had taken the records. Now, only thing we need to look at here is a dating matter. I don't know why Jeremiah had to say this happened in the second year of Judah's king Jehoram, because it introduces a lot of complexity which yours truly and you have got to try to wade through. So, first of all, the two names are, in some translations, exactly alike, Jehoram in the north and Jehoram in the south. Now, I like the Holman Christian Study Bible because they distinguish the two. If it's referring to the king of the north, he's called Joram, J-O-R-A-M, with no E-H-O in the, no E-H in it. He's Joram, not Jehoram, but some translations call him Jehoram. Well, to distinguish, I'm just, from now on in future audios, I'm going to call him the Northern Joram. I'm going to use a horrible southern redneck pronunciation of it, so you'll be able to distinguish. Joram He's in the north. In the south, Jehoshaphat had a son named Jehoram. Now, Joram in the north ruled from 852 to 841, and Jehoram in the south ruled from 848 to 841. Isn't that interesting? The northern Joram and the southern Jehoram died in the same year, 841. Now, that's the first thing that's confusing. The next thing is this remark that Joram took office in the second year of Jehoram. The northern Joram took office in the second year of the southern Jehoram. Well, the southern Jehoram is from 848 to 841. The second year of that would be 846, and that's not when Joram in the north took over. He took over 6 years earlier in 852. So how do you explain that? Well, the way this is explained is by co-regencies. King Jehoram was in the south, the southern King Jehoram. His single rule started in 848, but he co-ruled with Jehoshaphat in 854. Starting in 854, the second year of that co-regency would be 852, and that's when Joram started ruling. So that explains that discrepancy. The dating of the kings, that's what the PhD dissertation of that Edward Thiele, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, Thiele. His dates are universally accepted. Most everybody uses Thiele's dates, and I do too. The guy must have been a genius, writing back in the 1950s, and he goes all into the co-regency thing. And also, there has to be some reconciliation. Sometimes when the dates are a year off, well, that's because, I forgot which one. One of the kingdoms use accession year dating, and one says, no, we're not going to count the accession year. We're not going to start counting the first reign until the first full year after the accession. And, oh, it gets so complicated, we're not going to worry about that. In fact, we're going to put a lid on chapter 1 of 2 Kings, and we're now going, or at least in our next audio, we're going to 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 through 25, and we will see Elijah taken to heaven, his incredible ministry having been accomplished. I hope you stay tuned for that happy event, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.